Welcome back, hockey fans. This is episode 116 of ClapperCast Hockey Podcast. My name is Sean, and I'm hosting this week's episode. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone to make sure you check out our website, clappercast.com, to find all of our content and blog posts included. Recently, I've been working on an NHL one-hit wonder series that part three will be going up later this week, so check in for that. Also, make sure you follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at ClapperCast Media or on Twitter at ClapperCast. And there you'll find more content updates, the occasional meme, and some hockey news and updates throughout the week. And now onto this week's episode. So, over the past weekend, we got to experience the 2022 NHL All-Star Game. I'll hold for a minute here for the applause and the oohs and ahs. Just kidding, it was exactly as boring and uninteresting as every other All-Star Game in existence. I find that every year I try to give it another chance, just in the hopes that it'll be fun and different or even remotely watchable, and every single year I leave disappointed. This year was no different. It had hope, and it kind of looked like it would almost get decent, but with the never-ending awkward interviews and random celebrities trying to make the weekend culturally relevant, it all just falls flat. It sort of peaked, if you want to call it, in that awkward interview stage when Zach Werenski replied, "This is the first time I've been in the Bellagio fountain shooting pucks," when he was asked by Jerry D, "Do you practice that a lot?" I'm not exactly sure what else Werenski would have really been able to reply to that question anyways, but it's kind of the pinnacle of hockey player interviews in a sense. It was just missing a few you knows. So I mentioned in there that there was a point where it almost looked like it could be decent. So in the breakaway challenge, the NHL had brought in Trevor Zegras to participate, even though he wasn't in the actual All-Star game. So he joined Kirill Kaprizov, Jack Hughes, and Alex DeBrincat to kind of form this group of energetic, fun young players participating in the event in the hopes that they would actually do something fun to watch. Kaprizov took off his Wild jersey to reveal an Ovechkin jersey underneath, and he scored and then did the hot stick celly, which was pretty funny to watch, but it also made me realize that Kaprizov probably grew up like watching and idolizing Ovechkin, and it just kind of made us feel old. Then you had Jack Hughes, who did this pretty interesting creative magic trick act to kind of get the Vegas theme in there, and he sent out like a mini Hughes to go and score take the shot for him. And then Alex DeBrincat comes in with a full showmanship attempt and has the full Hangover movie setup going on. But Trevor Zegras kind of took it to the next level. He came out in an average Joe's outfit for the dodgeball-themed attempt. So he goes in blindfolded. He's got dodgeballs being thrown at him. And then he pulls off like a lacrosse-style spinorama puck toss into the net. Like, I can't even accurately describe what the move he pulled off was, but it was just an incredible display of skill and puck handling. It's to the point where you have the veteran players on the bench watching this, their jaws are on the floor, and they're openly saying, "I don't think I could have ever done that." It's just a testament to how skilled some of these players are right now. So anyways, at the end of the challenge, Alex Pietrangelo is the last player up. And any interest created from Trevor Zegras' attempt is immediately ruined here. Because Alex Pietrangelo does hit his attempt, misses the first one, gets, encored into a second attempt where he brings in a marching band to play the drums as he goes in and misses the net. But then one of the celebrity judges decides that he wants to be the star of the show today and gives Pietrangelo a 19 out of 10 to win because this guy's a Blues fan and Pietrangelo is the hometown player in this event in Vegas, and obviously a former Blue himself. So basically we just got Drew Carey from Whose Line interrupting to say everything's made up and the points don't matter. Because ultimately, Trevor Zegras is the people's champion here. Other than that, I mean, it's pretty boring to watch. It's hard to make it through the entire weekend in general. It's not that exciting or anything. And even the couple of events that they put in for specifically for Vegas hosting the All-Star game, shooting pucks in the Bellagio Fountain and the blackjack card shooting competition, like, they were neat gimmicks again, but they just weren't that fun to watch. And the game is basically just like watching a highly skilled drop-in session, and this season was just no different. It'll be interesting to see what happens next season when the NHL decides to try and revamp the All-Star game to get people interested, because once again, it doesn't seem to really ever work. Moving on to one of the bigger trade rumors that started getting a lot more attention over All-Star weekend, just with this particular player being so involved in the festivities of the weekend, is around Claude Giroux. Rumors have been heating up over the past couple weeks as the Flyers continue to struggle and they find themselves well out of competition. And Giroux has been with the Flyers his whole career since being drafted 22nd overall back in 2006. And so far, he's got 858 points in 943 games. Needless to say, seeing him in any other jersey will be a peculiar sight, and any other team that is lucky to bring his services on board for the rest of the season is going to be greatly, greatly pleased with what he can bring to their offensive depth. Now, Giroux does have a no-movement clause, so it's going to require him to actually waive it in order to be traded. So if he does want to stay in Philly, he will. but he could be a prime candidate to move to a competitor at the deadline next month, just with him hitting his mid-30s, and he might not have too many years left to win a cup. A few people around hockey have started suggesting some possible good fits. One of the biggest is the Colorado Avalanche, mentioned by Elliot Friedman, which that tells me there is something there, whether it's even something as little as a discussion having been had. Well, the Minnesota Wild, the Boston Bruins, and the Calgary Flames are other teams that have been mentioned as good fits for Giroux's skill set. Now, Giroux is also a rental, as he is in the last year of his contract right now, so the return may not be quite as much as some of the other defenders that we've talked about in past episodes, but you could still expect a high draft pick or two and a very good prospect, since Giroux is still playing around a 70-point pace over a full season. So Colorado, despite them being a prime candidate, they may have trouble with this, as they will have to free up a whole bunch of cap space, though I could anticipate someone like Burakovsky becomes expendable if they bring Giroux in. And they also don't likely have their first or second round pick in the upcoming draft. I think there's a couple of conditions that are dependent on where the draft pick would fall, like a first round that's top 10 protected or something. But given how Colorado's performing this year, that's not exactly an issue at all. So the likely scenario would be Colorado giving up draft picks into future years, like the 2023 draft possibly, as well as having a couple of decent prospects that are on the higher end, like Alex Newhook or Eustace Onanen. Next up, we have the Minnesota Wild, and they seem like a decent fit. They have the cap space, and they have some high-end prospects that they could move, and they also have all their draft picks. So the situation kind of lays itself out perfectly for Minnesota to make a bit of a push this year with bringing Claude Giroux in. Now, Minnesota is also 100% getting Giroux as a rental. They have no real hope of signing him past this season because their dead cap increases significantly, and this is kind of like their window is entirely on this season before they start losing $13 million per season in dead cap space on the Ryan Suter and Zach Parise buyouts. In terms of roster composition, Boston seems like a perfect fit, as they are really, really struggling in that 2C spot after Charlie Coyle didn't really stick there, and then they've kind of been rotating through Eric Halla and Thomas Noshik since. And they've even had to split up their Marchand, Bergeron, Pasternak line just to help with the depth scoring a bit, because it's not been great beyond those three. So Claude Giroux would be very welcome as a 2C to play alongside possibly Craig Smith and likely Taylor Hall. They might not have as great of a package to send back to the Philadelphia Flyers, but I'm sure they might be able to do something a bit more NHL ready, as Boston's prospect pool is a bit depleted right now. And it's sort of a similar situation here to the Calgary Flames, as they could really use a boost at 2C. With Sean Monahan dropping down even further this season in ice time, he's playing 14 minutes per game, likely in their third line center spot. And Mikael Backlund isn't quite a second line center. They could probably use someone like Giroux, who would be a little bit more of an offensive touch, and he'd play alongside Blake Coleman and Andre Mangiapane, who have been doing amazing this season lately. So we've now got Claude Giroux's name on the trade bait board. He's going to be pretty high on there, as he's a very valuable target. And whatever team lands him at the trade deadline, by the trade deadline, if he so chooses to waive that no movement clause, is going to be very happy with what they can get out of him. This is a story that's been brewing for a few weeks now that we haven't quite covered yet here on this podcast, and that's going to be the Arizona Coyotes arena situation. So we've mentioned months ago that this was something to keep an eye on as the season unfolded, as the Coyotes don't have an arena past this season, and the relocation talks had started, obviously, because, I mean, everyone talks about the Coyotes relocating every other year, so it's normal. But apparently, now they do have a plan to build an arena in Tempe, but that hasn't even been approved yet, so it doesn't exist. What the Coyotes are going to do in the meantime, you now wonder? The current plan is to have them play in a 5,000-seat arena at Arizona State University. And I've heard that the 5,000-seat part might even be lowered, because the arena is going to have to renovate to accommodate NHL infrastructure, I assume, like the cameras and the booths for that type of stuff. Gary Bettman is okay with this. He's promoting it. He is spinning this as a positive thing. I think the fans can have a lot of fun with it. The type of intimate experience they're going to have. These are things that he's saying about this situation. And he's even had the audacity to say that the Coyotes might produce better revenues if they go to this arena compared to their current situation under a model that they've used. And I don't think the spin on that one is fully working, because that mindset doesn't come across the way he thinks it does. It just kind of makes the whole situation look worse, that somehow this team is going to be more profitable playing in a smaller arena because they're not going to fill it up anyways, apparently. The proposal is just absurd to me. The thought of an NHL team willingly playing in an arena with like 3,200 to 5,000 seats, depending on what they end up with after renos, is baffling. There's CHL teams in Canada that play in bigger arenas than that. And I'm not talking the ones that share a rink with an NHL team. I remember back when Winnipeg's arena was coming into fruition for the Jets to become a team again. there was a concern that was going to be the size of the arena, because the Winnipeg Jets currently play in an arena that's about 15,000 seats compared to the 18,000 to 20,000 that most other arenas are. But here we are, and sure, it's temporary, but 3 to 4 seasons of this small of an arena is a very long time. So for once, I unfortunately have to side with the owners on something, and understandably so. But the teams, the owners, and other executives are pissed. And, like, of course they are. The other teams already prop up the Coyotes all the time with their revenue sharing. The size of this arena is just going to impact what's brought in even more and just take a toll on the entire league, I have to assume. Unless the Arizona is really losing that much money in Glendale, and this arena situation would be cheap enough to mitigate that entirely, like I guess the model Bettman has projects. It makes sense why they want to try so hard to keep the team in Arizona, given the size of the market and the money in the area, given the whole point of what they're trying to do is grow the game. But it's kind of hit a point where it's like, when is enough enough? It's almost embarrassing to see this being spun as a positive. And Bettman, in the same press conference, he's being pissy at the Canadian provincial governments for various COVID restrictions, but he's trying to tell us that the Coyotes playing in a 5,000-seat arena is a good thing. It's just a joke to me. As something that has been well documented and brought up, the Chicago Blackhawks are an absolute clown show of a franchise right now, and a whole bunch more has happened in this past week to just help confirm that descriptor. So at a town hall with Rocky Wirtz, Danny Wirtz, and a couple of others within the organization, Rocky Wirtz had an absolute meltdown on stage in response to a question about what the team was going to do to prevent what happened to Kyle Beach from happening again in the future. Now, I'll play the audio here for full effect. It's about a minute and 15 seconds long, since me reading a transcript won't do the gravity of the response justice.
Back also, and I think much of what happened to Kyle Beach stemmed from a power imbalance between a coach and a player and the powerlessness of a player in that situation. So what are the Blackhawks doing? What have the Blackhawks done? What will the Blackhawks do to empower a player in a similar situation to make sure that doesn't happen again?
I'm going to answer the question at the end. I think the report speaks for itself. The people that were involved are no longer here. We're not looking back at 2010. We're looking forward. And we're not going to talk about 2010.
I know,
and I'm not either. And we're not going to talk about what happened. We're moving forward. That is my answer. Now, what's your next question?
I can pick up to what we are doing today. And I think
That's none of your business. That's none of your business. What we're going to do today is our business. I don't think it's any of your business.
How is it not my business?
Because I don't think it's any of your business. You don't work for the company. If someone in the company asks that question, we'll answer it. And I think you should get on to the next subject. We're not going to talk about Kyle Beach. We're not going to talk about anything that happened. Now we're moving on. What more do I have to say? You want to keep asking the same question? Do you hear the same answer? Okay, ask the next question. Okay.
So this is just a disgusting answer. We have a team that just spent over a decade covering up Kyle Beach's story, hiding it, pretending it didn't happen. Like, whatever phrase is synonymous with sweeping it under the rug that you can come up with. And then in the aftermath, the owner of the team comes out and says, it's none of your business what we're doing. In case we're wondering why or where the mentality that led to this being covered up for 10 years comes from, it's going to start right there. Rich, ignorant, old money sending directive, top-down orders, not caring about repercussions, and is completely out of touch with what these orders are creating farther down in the organization. Throw money at the problem and make it go away. I don't care. Get rid of it. As the organization was settling its lawsuit with Kyle Beach, they put out a PR statement reading, and I quote, "As for the Blackhawks organization, we remain steadfast in our commitment to ensure that going forward, this team will be a beacon for professionalism, respect, and integrity in our community. We remain grateful for the trust and support of the Blackhawks community, and we promise to continue working every day to earn and maintain that trust." Rocky Wirtz then says, "It's none of your business what we're doing." A whole part of the aftermath of the situation and the plan moving forward is transparency and accountability. None of the original process was transparent, and no one was really held accountable, since Aldrich was able just to move along to work with students and get in even more trouble there. But then Wirtz has the audacity to pretty much state that transparency isn't important. Like, again, how out of touch can one be with the situation? Now, Gary Bettman had an amazing weekend of press conferences. They were fantastic responses to stuff. But as a part of his All-Star Weekend press conference, Gary Bettman addressed this, and he more or less brushed it off, calling it an emotional outburst out of frustration. that he isn't really involved in the day-to-day stuff anymore, and that the people who are running things are doing the right things to create a better environment, along with no repercussions or discipline for this answer. Another key focus there of Wirtz's outburst was the desire to put that in the past, to move on, to not dwell on it moving forward, aka sweeping it under the rug again. Well, Rocky, you can't move on quite yet, because since this little temper tantrum, news broke that three more people are considering lawsuits against the franchise, including the player identified as Black Ace One in the original report, and Paul Vincent, a skills coach with the team at the time, who claims he was demoted for speaking up. Additionally, the athletic trainer of the team's AHL affiliate was just fired recently for sexual harassment. The incident occurred back in 2014, and it was reported to the team back in October. So, no, looks like you can't stop talking about it yet, because there are clearly still issues being brought forth, and you clearly don't have the right mentality to be involved in this. Might be time to fully remove himself from the equation to make sure that whatever impact he's got on the culture of this organization is out of the way so that they can actually try and fix things moving forward. That wraps things up for this time here on Clappercast. Make sure you rate and review this episode and toss a follow or subscribe our way. For more content, you can follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Clappercast Media or on Twitter at Clappercast. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more hockey talk.